If you're like me and always on the lookout for a new podcast, then I've got a suggestion for you. There's a new podcast by Radio Wolfgang called Unburnable. It's about a pretty unique court case that's coming up in Norway. Two environmental groups, Greenpeace and Nature and Youth, have decided to fight climate change in a completely new way. They're taking the Norwegian government to court over their decision to open up the Arctic to oil drilling, arguing that any oil taken out from these new fields will be what's known as unburnable carbon. Research has indicated we have already discovered enough oil that if burnt will raise the planet's temperature to very dangerous levels. So these guys are actually going to sue the Norwegian government and are doing so by using Norway's own constitution, which safeguards the right of future generations to a clean and healthy environment, against them. This is a massive legal battle and loads of people from all over the world are behind it. And so to check out this new podcast, search for Unburnable wherever you get your podcasts, or visit savethearctic.org to get involved.
This episode of Felon may contain disturbing content, including descriptions of violence and coarse language. Listener discretion is advised.
On this episode of Felon, we visit one of the darkest corners of Australian criminal history. Our tour guide will be true crime expert, Jack Sim. Jack Sim is an author, true crime tour guide, managing director of the infamous Boggo Road Jail in Queensland, and, in an era that predated podcasts, was the host of Australia's longest running true crime radio program, Crime at Nine. Jack was generous enough to take some time out of his busy schedule to share one of Queensland's most brutal and shocking crimes. There are two backdrops for this story, Boggo Road Jail and Sanford. One, a notorious jail that housed some of the most disturbed and violent offenders in Australian history, where many of these offenders met their end at the gallows. The other, a small quiet farming town around a 30-minute drive from the Queensland capital of Brisbane. Two very different places, and yet one tragic incident would forge a connection between the two that would still be remembered over a century later. We begin this story in the town of Sanford. The year is 1913. It was here in Sanford that 11-year-old Ivy Mitchell lived with her father, her stepmother, and brother. Ivy's father was a farmer, and the family lived on the outskirts of Sanford. This area was connected by dirt roads. The children of the time would use these roads to travel to and from school and visit their friends who lived in the area. But it was along one of these dirt roads that a tragic incident occurred, which would change the town forever.
The story began with a young girl by the name of Ivy Mitchell. Young Ivy attended the Parker State School. Her stepmum and dad lived at Sanford, which was on the sort of western side of Brisbane. It wasn't considered to be part of Brisbane. It was a long, long way from the city centre. It was closer, really, to the Pine River Shire. It was quite isolated. Her people were farmers, like nearly everyone that lived in Sanford. For listeners that might not know Sanford, to this day, it remains a rural sort of hamlet, very popular for weekend drives, for car clubs, and for people to go on excursions. They have a fine museum out there dedicated to the area. The Mitchells were then part of a close community of people who were striving to sort of, you know, make a living. It was Sunday the 8th of June 1913. It was a very ordinary day for the Sanford community. Ivy attended church with her family. After church, as was sort of the custom of the time, families would all go and have picnics and catch up with each other. No one worked on a Sunday in those days. after working hard on their farms during the week. And Ivy was very excited because her dad and her stepmum were going to go and visit some neighbours, and they offered to drop Ivy at her friend Mary Frisch's house so she could play with her. It was only about a kilometre from the Mitchells' home that young Mary lived with her parents and family. After playing the day there, Mrs. Frisch wrapped up some lovely flowers for Ivy's stepmum and also gave her a small bag of sweets. Ivy chatted with her friend a little bit longer before departing. She started walking down the road. Another young child that she knew and that child's brother started to chat to Ivy a little bit. By that time, it was starting to get dark and she had a little way to get home. So Ivy quickly said goodbye to them and then took off. And sadly, those three children were the last to see Ivy alive. It was not long after once night had fell that the family of Ivy became rather concerned because, being a little girl, you know, she was out in the dark. I think their first thoughts were that she perhaps had had an accident or been distracted. But as it got darker and darker and night began to take hold, they became very concerned that she may have met with, you know, something. I wouldn't think that foul play first came into their mind. It would have been more that something's happened to her. You know, she's been hurt or is lying on the side of the road. So the Mitchells approached their neighbours and various families contributed to the search for Ivy.
By 6:30 p.m., Ivy's father, James Mitchell, set off in the direction where Ivy was last seen. With hurricane lamps lighting their way, they travelled to the home of the Smith family, where they are told that Ivy passed there more than an hour ago. They then retrace their steps, and in the light of their lanterns, they find two sets of footprints. These footprints would lead them to a horrific discovery.
Her brother and her father found her. Her body was found lying beside a log in some fairly dense scrub, and they found her using hurricane lanterns. And, you know, the sight that greeted them was horrific. I'm always reluctant to sort of go into the details of horrific murders involving children. It's always, to me, always seems something that's sort of almost sacred to not go into. But Ivy had been very badly treated. Her throat had been slashed. There were deep gashes in her neck, and it was clear that she tried to sort of fight off her assailant. Things moved quite quickly thereafter. The community rallied behind the Mitchells. Police arrived. One of the most unique elements of their investigation was they took plaster casts of boot prints that were found around the body. They made a preparation of plaster of Paris and recorded the impressions, which was quite a unique and for the first time that I had ever heard of, they did such a thing. They realised that obviously whoever had left the prints around her body it must have been the perpetrator. So police found large footprints around the body. They also found some tracks from a horse. They followed the tracks to a water tank next to the state school that Ivy attended, and there, near the water tap of the tank, it left a perfect boot print. And so they took a cast of that boot print, and they knew that the pivotal to their apprehending someone would be to match that boot to an individual.
Authorities determined that the perpetrator used the tap at the water tank to wash the blood from his hands. A witness reported to authorities that they had seen Ivy walking hand in hand with a heavy-set man who was leading a saddled horse. This was estimated to be around 5:30 p.m. Another witness shared with police that he had seen a man that he recognized riding a horse at Cedar Creek, coming from the direction of the Parker Primary School, which was near where they found Ivy's body. This witness had a short conversation with the man before the man on the horse galloped off, explained that he had to get home to milk the cows. The witness identified the man as Ernest Austin, a local farm labourer who had been employed by a number of families in the area and who was known by the Mitchell family. Authorities set about to locate Ernest Austin.
Austin, by this time, was staying at the Fogg family farm. It was there that the police confronted him. At first, he denied he had anything to do with it. Police asked him about his boots, which were missing. He claimed that he lost them. He initially told the police he didn't know the Mitchells, but he was taken and shown the body. Once again, said he didn't know her, but in time, he began to sort of admit elements of his involvement. The police found the soles of his boots, which he'd ripped off and thrown, discarded, and they were a perfect match to the print that they'd taken. So there was no doubt that he was the perpetrator. Austin was already, had already attempted to attack another young woman only a few weeks before. And although he worked with people in the community, passed through a few different farms, everyone was suspicious of him. He was not a good worker. He would tend to sort of not quite finish every task that he was given. And those that got to sort of know him found him a little bit difficult. Christian Hansen, whose father had employed Austin and allowed Austin to live on their farm for quite a number of weeks, would later say that he distrusted Austin, that there was something about him that he found, you know, that he thought was untoward. So little did the Hansons realise, or anyone, that in their midst, Ernest Austin was indeed a monster. Austin had prior history for violent offences against a child and had served time in Pentridge Prison in Victoria, where he was in fact originally from. Austin was a classic example of a made monster, as I would refer to them. A poor family life, a mother that was sort of indifferent to him. He obviously had some type of a learning disability. Today we would apply resources and care to such a person to try to help them. But Austin, at that time in the very early 1900s, he was more or less at the mercy of the street, and he gradually over time found himself getting into more and more serious crime, and eventually he was stopped just moments before he almost certainly was going to kill another young girl that lived near his mother's home, and was sent to Pentridge Prison to serve time. After serving his time in Pentridge, he was released, and not too long after, he made the decision to sort of leave Victoria and head to Queensland. And what's striking about this crime, it might be 1913, but Australia today is dealing with similar problems right across the nation of people, you know, particularly violent male offenders who move with impunity between states and perpetrate crimes, and the lack of a very good, you know, 100 years later, the failure of us to have a good mechanism to be able to monitor these individuals is inexcusable. You know, we've had a century or more to try and get this sort of thing right. Back in 1913, the Mitchells and the other people of Sanford had no idea when Austin walked into their district knocking on the door looking for work, that they had a man with an extensive and growing violent history, and having served jail, and, you know, including having served jail time. Austin was ultimately to be put on trial in the Supreme Court. Didn't take long for the jury to pass some judgment to give their verdict that he was guilty. The judge passed the death sentence upon him, and it wasn't too long before Austin was facing his end. It was on the 22nd of September 1913 that Austin stepped onto the gallows at Boggo Road Jail. He was to become the 42nd person hanged by the neck at Boggo Road Jail. It was the case that he was in time, as Queensland abandoned the death penalty, and eventually in 1922 the death penalty was repealed. You know, history sort of declared that he was the last man hanged. You know, no one else was ended up following him. And so in time, his crime, his execution has taken on this sort of legendary status.
This legendary status that Jack mentions is where the tragedy of Sanford becomes entwined with the story of Boggo Road Jail. The very first cell block of Boggo Road Jail opened on the 2nd of July, 1883. From the time of its construction right through to its closure in 1992, Boggo Road Jail housed some of Queensland's most vile and dangerous criminals, of which many were hanged on the gallows within its walls. And yet, after all these years, after its closure, countless witnesses have sworn that some former occupants still walk the corridors. And if you believe the stories, it seems that Ernest Austin still has a lingering presence. The story of the ghost of Ernest Austin was passed down by inmates within the jail, decade after decade. As part of his research for his book, Ghosts of Boggo Road Jail, Jack Sim interviewed a number of ex-inmates and ex-prison guards that spent time in the jail and had eerie experiences while they were there.
I've interviewed over 60 ex-officers and inmates on our list of people that form at the basis of a lot of our content on tours and in the books. And some of those people included officers who worked at the jail back as far as the mid-1930s. And the ghost story of Ernest Austin was in circulation in 1935. He was executed in 1913, but Bill Carney, who I counted as a close friend, who was a prison officer, when he started work in 1935 at Boggo Road Jail, the story of a ghost of the last man hanged, Ernest Austin, was already entrenched. So we're talking, you know, 22 years later, two decades after the execution, there was already a ghost story circulating about him. I think that ghost story was almost certainly fanned by, in part, by both officers and inmates. It's interesting, the ghost story of Ernest Austin told it by prisoners in the 1980s was not transmitted, you know, it didn't exist in the digital age. They didn't Google it. They didn't read a book. How they learned about it was it would have been a fellow inmate, a long-term prisoner, who would have shared that story in some way. It would probably would have required a context, like a night where, you know, there was thunder and lightning or something, or an afternoon like that, and the next morning when they all gathered in a yard, someone would say, "Did you see the ghost of Ernie last night?" And they'd apply that creepy story to some new prisoner to try and scare him, you know. That's sort of how I imagine. I know from one prisoner, I mean, that's how he learned it. Was he was literally an older inmate told him the tale and sort of scoffed at whether it was true or not, but that's sort of how it was transmitted. Like, in terms of a specific encounter, I'll be truthful, I've rarely found prisoners who actually saw the ghost of Austin. You know, there's several versions of what it does and such. I mean, it was said that if you looked out through your peephole at night when the cell block was locked up and there's no officer in the block, the lights are turned out, on a rainy night with lightning in the sky, Austin would come back. He would walk along the corridor outside your cell, and you know, if he heard you make a noise, he would come to your door and then come through the door and then strangle you. You know, there was that version. And a couple of prisoners had told me over the years that they looked out their peephole and they'd seen Ernest Austin, you know, out walking past on the other side of, you know, across from them, or, you know, little anecdotes like that of prisoners that claim they'd had that close encounter, you know, with the ghost.
Jack Sim currently leads ghost tours at the jail. And the question he gets asked on a regular basis is, has he ever seen the ghost of Ernest Austin?
You know, a common question I get asked, like, you know, have I ever seen him? And I can tell you that there are times there at night during tours, and also sometimes when you're locking up and such, like, I am certain there is something there, like a dark and sort of evil being. It's the only way to describe it. You don't really see them as such. It's only once, I swear, I think I saw him at the top of a staircase as I was locking up a cell block. I saw like a shadow move at the very top of a cell block as I was locking it up inside the block. And I knew there was no, you know, no member of the public there.
The body of Ernest Austin lies buried in the section of a cemetery known as the Devil's Plot. It is a section of unconsecrated land where the most despicable of criminals are buried. Regardless of whether Ernest Austin does still reside in the jail at Boggo Road, his cruel actions that led to the brutal death of 11-year-old Ivy Mitchell haunted the lives of her family and community far more than any ghost story ever could.
The community out there, of course, was destroyed. Ivy's dad and family were just, you know, devastated. They never, ever recovered. They ultimately packed up and left Sanford and to never return. You know, in this day and age, 2017, you know, we look at crimes with a completely different perspective on the community. In fact, horrifically, we've all become a little bit more numbed these days to awful crime that happens so frequently. In 1913, crimes committed against children of this nature were almost unheard of in Queensland. And in Sanford, it was the, you could not pick a more unlikely location for something like this. I couldn't even imagine what it would be like for Ivy's dad and brother to find her like this, and then to have to go back and report what they'd found.
Thanks for listening. A big thank you to Jack Sim for making this episode possible. If you're ever in Brisbane, be sure to stop by Boggo Road Jail to say hi.
If people want to come and experience it for themselves, Rod, they just, you know, can Google Boggo Road Jail Ghost Tours or Boggo Road Jail with a G, GAOL.com. And you know, if they want to buy my books, they can get them from my website, jacksim.com.au. Oh, look, if anyone listening to your podcast walks into the jail and buys a ticket, if they say felon, I'll give them a discount, give them a 10% discount on a tour.
Good deal. Awesome. I might fly out myself.
Thanks, mate. I better get flying. Okay,
yeah,
and
thanks heaps for that.
All right. Yeah, good to talk to you. We'll do some more.
Yeah, cool. Bye. Have a good one.